Tuesday night edition of the pod. I'm glad that we waited until tonight to record. If you're wondering our thoughts on Boston and Philly, those are coming later in the show. But first, we had to get to this classic game one in Toronto. Cavaliers 113, Raptors 112. And we will get into the very end of this game. We'll do our signature play-by-play breakdowns. But just overall, after this game, how does this leave you thinking about the series? Like, what observations can we take away from this one?
After every single game that Indiana won of their first round series against Cleveland, or sorry, every game Cleveland won, we talked about how Indiana could have, you know, what would kind of haunt them about it. It was a game that they could have won. And all of that was just prologue. All of that was just leading into this one, where I thought overall, you know, there were certainly some positives that Cleveland can take away from this game. But overall, this was, I would expect that this could be the worst game Cleveland plays in this entire series. And yet, despite it being on the road against an amped up crowd, a lot of different Raptors, I thought, did some positive things out there. Cleveland still comes away with the win.
I would draw a distinction, and I'm not saying that you felt that there was a difference in the series or not. It wasn't clear on what you were saying exactly. But to me, I felt like in those games that Indiana lost, that I still came away thinking that they were the better team and that they were playing better in the series. I did not feel that way about the Raptors. Certainly, they led throughout much of the night. They looked good early, but Cleveland got up 35 three-point attempts. Kyle Korver got 12 three-point attempts in this game. J.R. Smith got 6, although he was 5 out of 6, obviously. Those guys combined for 10 of Cleveland's 14 three-point makes. And while Kevin Love continues to really struggle, and it's unclear, we'll talk more about him, he's going to be an asset in this series, I thought that it just looked like Cleveland was playing better. Their offense was flowing better after the first quarter, and I didn't feel like the Raps really have the solution to stop this Cavaliers team, despite the fact that I thought they did a pretty decent job on LeBron James.
I thought they did as well. And yeah, I actually, well, so or it's not as severe as...
Let me rephrase that, actually.
Sure.
I thought that OG Anunoby in one,
there
in
we go,
defense on LeBron James did a good job. The rest of it didn't really look that good when they're able to do something other than just trying to have LeBron ISO.
Right. And I think that's an important distinction to make. But I think what leads to it was not as severe as you were mentioning, that the Pacers outplayed the Cavs. I'm not sure that the Raptors really did in this game. I thought a lot of it was also Cleveland shots in the early part of it just not falling. You know, they were getting some. But what justified that statement for me was the way that the Raptors were exploiting Kevin Love early, and Valanciunas was just beasting on him, especially in the first quarter. Yeah. Eventually, that advantage was mitigated by just playing Kevin Love in a different role. You know, I thought Tristan Thompson did a nice job overall in this game. Also hit all 4 of his free throws, which was significant. And so the Raptors had some advantages that ended up, you know, not fully materializing. And also, you know, this isn't necessarily playing well or playing badly necessarily, but, you know, LeBron will not go 12 of 30 from the field very often, 1 of 8 from 3, and miss 5 of his 6 free throws. I mean, there was that crazy stretch in the Pacers series where he hit like 22 in a row or whatever that was. So I don't think that you can walk away from this game beyond all of the other obvious historical reasons for the Raptors feeling as good as maybe the Pacers could have from some of their early losses in that Cavs series of, hey, we can hang with these guys, because this was a game that, to me, Toronto had, whether or not you say they should have won it, they certainly had plenty of chances to win it.
Well, and now they've also lost the home court advantage, and Cleveland has been an absolute house of horrors for Toronto. Even this season, it was. And that's a major concern. And I think, you know, you can take a little heart. J.R. Smith has not been playing this well. For him to have 20 points, 5-6 on threes. For Jeff Green to have 13 points in the first half and 16 overall on 8 shooting possessions. Probably not going to happen again. They did give up 9 offensive rebounds in 26 minutes to Tristan Thompson. That's not very good. And I think that's something that is going to continue to be an issue with the level of help that they have to have. They had no answers for the LeBron pick and roll with a small Korver, Smith. Like, that's how they got that lead in the overtime, which we'll talk more about. I do think, though, that Toronto can take heart that DeRozan looked pretty good. You know, I think that they really should have almost gone to him more, that he almost wasn't aggressive enough. At times, he passed up a couple of big shots late where I thought he had the advantage on Smith. And they can take heart from how well OG did. I mean, the first thing you have to do against LeBron is, all right, we got to have someone who can guard him that he can't just like put under the goal, and we have to double team every single time he posts up. And OG, to me, I mean, I can't remember just a pure wing guarding LeBron who in a playoff series who is as strong as him. And we've seen like a PJ Tucker or, you know, maybe Draymond or something, but, you know, Ananobi is really like a wing defensively. And LeBron really, I'm not going to say that he couldn't move him, but he was not able to move him as easily as he normally can. Oh, sorry, the cat just got up. He was on my lap. He's going to have to get deposited on the ground here. Yeah, sorry, you were saying?
And that's also part of why I got really frustrated during the fourth quarter in this game. When LeBron is playing, and they often had Pascal Siakam on LeBron, and Siakam's playing small forward. It's not like they were big or some sort of weird alignment or something else like that. It's like, okay, you have one guy who's done a pretty good job on LeBron. I would say a very good job overall, you know, in those one-on-one circumstances. OG ended up, because the game went to overtime, he went all the way to 30 minutes. But strike while the iron is hot. You know, you have a guy who's done a nice job here. Have him out there for these moments, especially because Ananobi doesn't shoulder a big offensive burden. So I'm not nearly as worried about him tiring out in that same sense of, you know, like we've said, John Wall, you don't want to burn the candle at both ends with him. He's a point guard. He has the ball in his hands all the time. Ananobi, his job is to slow down LeBron James. If he's doing well, you want him out there for more than 25 minutes in regulation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Bringing him back in with only 4 minutes remaining in regulation, playing Siakam at the three with Ibaka and JV really seemed like a losing strategy offensively. And then for Cleveland, they went back to Kevin Love at center. I think the reason they did that is they thought that they could put Valanciunas into some difficulty, but Valanciunas completely won his matchup with Love. He was killing him in the post. Pick and roll defense, Love wasn't able to really do anything either. So they went to Tristan Thompson, and they also went with just playing Jeff Green at center as well. And that's really how they got back in the game in the second quarter. Love ended up with five fouls. He actually ended up sitting out, and I'm not sure, again, that he was that positive of a player in this game. But I think they probably need to start Thompson going forward with as well as he played. He makes their defense a lot better. Gives them a lot more switchability. And for Love, I mean, it really, the only explanation that I can come up with for how poorly he's played in these playoffs is that left thumb injury is killing him. And people might say, and here's some stats on that. I didn't look this up as of the end of the game, but I don't think he took any inside shots. He actually made one hook shot after I looked this up. But as like middle of the game, I looked it up. He was 6 out of 18 at the rim and 3 out of 14 from floater zone, which is usually like his jump hook, which is a reliable shot for him. And, you know, some people might say, oh, come on, it's your left thumb. Like, what does that have to do? He's shooting all these shots right-handed. Well, number one, if you can't shoot a shot left-handed, you have to bring your right hand back into the defense more often. That's difficult. But number two, imagine like, just do this exercise at home. Just like imagine that your right thumb is taped to your index finger, right? It's just useless. Now, if you try to bring the ball up and put it into your right hand, you're not going to have the control to put it into your right hand. And so you won't have as good of a grip on the ball as you try to go up with that right hand. That's what I have no idea whether that's what it is, but I mean, and he's not the most athletic guy in the world, but for him to be shooting this poorly, like there has to be some kind of an injury component, I would imagine.
Well, you also see it on other plays, like where Love, he sometimes tries to get a rebound and it slips out a little bit, or tries to make a pass and the touch on it isn't quite right. I mean, I think you see it in a lot of other elements as well. I mean, his defense sucks for other reasons, but I notice it. It seems to me like it's affecting him. And a lot of times with these kinds of injuries, the player won't make excuses. You just kind of go, well, that's the way it is. But I do think that it has been affecting him. And the idea behind starting Love at center with Valanciunas was a sound one, that he would take Valanciunas out of his comfort areas, that maybe JV wouldn't be able to exploit Love's defensive issues in that's like strongly enough to justify that sort of a change. That logic was sound. That logic ended up not holding, at least for this game. And they have enough options, you know, with Tristan Thompson to make this work, and then some of the weaknesses in their perimeter rotation actually get muted a little bit, which can be a positive thing for Cleveland. Something else that I think is very interesting and potentially significant, beyond some of the other guys on the, I'm calling them them, the February 8th crew, the guys that Cleveland added on the trade deadline, not having bad nights, Larry Nance didn't have a night because Larry Nance did not play in this game.
Yeah, they traded a first rounder basically for Larry Nance. I mean, I guess you could also say, and in fact, you'd make the argument that they valued Larry Nance more than a first rounder because they also took on a bad contract in Clarkson. Maybe they just weren't smart enough to realize that that was a bad contract. I think they are coming to that conclusion rather quickly in these playoffs. But so, and this guy is now not playing for them, you know, I mean, and maybe he'll play more if they start to reduce Love's playing time a little bit, but he didn't really make the impact. You know, we thought that he was going to be running all these pick and rolls and getting up for alley-oops, and that just has not been the case at all, partially because he hasn't really had a chance to play center with their best spacing units, you know, so, but, you know, defensively, he hasn't really had that much of an effect. Should we talk about the end of the game?
Just briefly before that, I mentioned LeBron having, you know, a rougher night from the field than you expect, 12 for 30, just to run through it briefly. 6 of 8 in the restricted area. Sure, that's strong for LeBron. Yeah, and if you want to add
but
in...
only 8 shots of his 30 in the restricted area. I mean, you remember in
that's
that
true.
Pacers series, I mean, he shot...
he had 11 in the first half.
Every single one of his shots in a half in the restricted area.
Yes, and then, so LeBron...
And free throws, too.
Also, 6 free throws.
Yeah,
6 free throw attempts in the whole game. Missed 5 of those 6. He was a similar, or an identical, 1 of 6 in floater range, more shots than usual from there, also a lower success rate, 4 of 8 from mid-range. Yeah, that's, you know, in the area for LeBron, but then 1 of 8 on above the break threes. And so the proportions, as you mentioned, that I think that's somewhat significant, you know, that it's basically even between all 4 zones, and that he, you know, that he wasn't making the shots from floater range, which you'd expect to go in a little bit more, and threes to go in more than 1 for 8 for sure.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, I think we both expect him to shoot better as the series goes along. Let's talk about the end of the game now. We can pick it up here, and there were some incredible sequences before this. There was Valanciunas missing like 3 straight tip-ins and then getting fouled and then missing another shot on the immediately ensuing possession. You know, it definitely felt like Toronto had their chances but wasn't getting them. And we'll pick it up with 1:52 remaining, and that's when Serge Ibaka, Raptors are only up 1. Cleveland still had never led, I think, at this point. Ibaka gets a 3-shot foul. We didn't even see where the foul occurred, but LeBron, as he planted to actually go run back for the rebound after contesting Ibaka's shot, put his foot out, and Ibaka came down, slightly sprained his ankle, and committed a clear foul. So Ibaka makes all 3, Raptors by 4. Of course, that was their last score in regulation. The Cleveland came down and pretty quickly attacked. This is, they started going to the pick and roll with Korver and LeBron, and Ananobi, in one of his few mental errors, another one, he gave up an alley-oop for an and one off an inbounds earlier in the game, doesn't force Korver to use the screen. And especially when it's a shooter, you're going to be hedging, you have to force him to use the screen, because otherwise there's going to be nobody behind you. And that's exactly what happened. And LeBron's able to get right to the rim. There was no help available, so that got him within 2. And feel free to break in if you have anything to add on any of these, Danny.
Next
time down, DeMar DeRozan pick and roll with Korver's man. I thought that actually worked really well. He gets into the lane, gets Ibaka a wide open left corner 3 that missed, and that basically could have ended the game. And Love gets a great rebound among like 4 guys. But then, you know, because he can't hold the ball with that left hand, he has to kind of put it in, like, you know, like he's a running back receiving the handoff, and may have traveled. Then he clearly gets fouled by DeRozan. DeRozan has like an arm on his back, but Love then has to start like swinging his elbows, or feels like he has to, and he just clocks DeRozan right in the jaw. I think it probably should have been a foul on DeRozan before it even got to that point, but it ends up being a turnover. However, because Love actually had possession, it wasn't a loose ball foul. It just ended up being a turnover. If it had been a loose ball foul, DeRozan gets 2 free throws out of that. That could have been huge.
Yeah. And they also could have theoretically reviewed it for being something greater than that. It wasn't elbow that hit a guy in the jaw. We've seen plays like that get reviewed. And, you know, I think the overall outcome was kind of in the realm. I agree with you that a DeRozan foul would have been the most equitable. Love would have never swung his elbows had they called the original foul, and there was an original foul.
And so if you're just going to let people foul him over and over again and try to take the ball away and get him in a jump ball, like, what choice does he have but to start swinging around like that?
I agree with that. But so then the Raptors get the ball back, but they don't get free throws, and I'm sure they would have rather had free throws, especially for DeRozan, than what ended up happening.
Yeah, as it turned out, oh, the other crazy play that was before this time frame that I wanted to mention, I forgot that it was before this, was Lowry getting hung up after DeRozan missed Ibaka wide open for a three early in the possession. He ended up having to throw it out. Lowry gets hung up. He calls timeout with two on the shot clock. That's one of their two remaining timeouts under 3 minutes. This is with like 2:27 remaining. And then they instantly get a 5 second violation. Don't even get the ball in. Although,
yeah, it was completely insane.
It was a good job by Lowry not compounding the error by calling another timeout because they couldn't get the ball in bounds and using their last timeout to preserve a 2 second on the shot clock opportunity. But yeah, that wasn't the greatest execution in the world there. But so the Raptors run some time down. Lowry has to go to a pull-up over LeBron. I thought that LeBron guarding Lowry down the end. LeBron had a couple of plays on Lowry in the third quarter, it was late in the first half, where Lowry tried to drive on him in transition one time. He just got stopped and then turned it over. Another time, he tried to drive past him, got past him, but then was so worried about the block, LeBron didn't even really jump on either of those, and then he just like threw it off the backboard for his layup. And so it seems clear that Lowry was a little bit intimidated of trying to attack LeBron, and Lowry's not really a great one-on-one player at this stage either. So he misses that, and then James tries to back in on Ananobi, doesn't really get anywhere, and just makes an impossible right shoulder fadeaway to tie it up at 105.
And then you get into one of the more interesting decisions. You and I did not watch this game together, and I was kind of wondering how you thought about it, because when Toronto didn't call a timeout, I started clapping and I said, good job, Toronto, just run through it. And there were two reasons why I felt that way. One is, we know that all of the guys Toronto is going to run their offense through are already on the floor, because, you know, Lowry, DeRozan, they could have put in, and they did, put in support players on that. But the second part, which I thought was significantly more important, is you know Cleveland's going to use a timeout after this. So if you call a timeout, Cleveland is going to put in all of their defensive personnel. And the difference between Cleveland's personnel to tie the game versus their defensive personnel was more significant than the difference for Toronto.
Well, I thought at the time it was a good use of the timeout because there's no chance that Toronto was going to need it later, right? This was going to be their last possession. They weren't going to need it to advance the ball because there was only a 6 second differential. Number two, I thought it was important to use the timeout to just call something where you make sure you get in your players' heads. We got to run the time down here as much as possible. And I did think that like getting Ananobi out of the game, they had Valanciunas in the game, but they put in Van Vliet. I thought that the spacing that they had really allowed them to get that great shot that they did. I mean, you can't argue that it didn't work. I mean, they got a wide open shot to win the game, and then they got a bunch of tips.
Oh, I agree with all that.
So I agree that Cleveland getting their defensive replacements in the game was helpful. But I didn't think there was a clear-cut answer either way, especially when you throw in the fact that, I mean, they didn't really have any advantage in transition, right? He didn't call the timeout until they tried to push it up, as I recall, a little bit. But you're always...
Yeah, that's right. They didn't really push it up with any real force there, but they didn't have any advantage.
And you got to run the time down in that situation anyway. So I think that's the biggest thing, was just making sure that your players know, hey, we have to run the time down here. And they got a nice play, too. They're able to get DeRozan off a double screen onto George Hill. They had switched LeBron onto DeRozan, but that got switched off, and then DeRozan had Hill beat, but he kind of fumbled it, and then help came, but they were able to get the pass to Van Vliet, who was wide open at the top, and he just missed the three. You know, he was seen earlier in the game with ice on that injured shoulder talking to the trainer. His shot really was not that close. They also had CJ Miles in the game, so I can't think of who else I would have rather had in there if I were the Raptors at that point. Van Vliet's an excellent three-point shooter. So then DeRozan got a tip, Valanciunas got a tip, DeRozan's tip almost went in, Valanciunas's tip with the left hand, it looked like it was going to go in. Cleveland finally gets the rebound with 0.6 left. I thought at this point, with that little time remaining, they're clearly going to inbound it to James. And I didn't really care for the Raptors' strategy. They had Valanciunas on the inbounder. And while people are always criticized, okay, you know, you have to like pressure the inbounder more, you know, I think when you're going full court, it matters a little bit more. But when the other team might actually throw it more than just the obvious place to LeBron, you know it's going to LeBron. So I think I would have rather either just brought in someone more mobile and then double teamed LeBron because he got a screen. Lowry was on him. Lowry is already too small. And then LeBron just ghosted Lowry with a cut, got wide open. And
he also pushed off, but it was within the realm that you would never call an offensive foul.
Like that have a push off in him. I mean,
spoken like a true Chicago native, my friend.
Yeah. Well, Chicago was on the losing end of one of those in 1998 as well.
That's also true.
Game four against the Pacers. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. And I think LeBron, he just really rushed it with 0.6. If you have time, I think really to shoot your normal shot in that situation, just ask Chris Middleton about that. But he missed it. We go into overtime, and then Cleveland got out to an early lead. They got two open threes, one for Korver and then one for Smith out of James Korver pick and roll, putting DeRozan in pick and roll. And the Raps were not interested in switching DeRozan onto LeBron, understandably so, because DeMar DeRozan can't guard LeBron. And I've always thought that teams should go after DeRozan more than they do. And they had DeRozan guarding Korver. I think that I would much rather go after DeRozan than Lowry. Teams usually go after Lowry when they try small pick and rolls against the Raptors. And it worked exceedingly well.
Yeah, it did. And it resulted in those two threes by Korver and Smith. And it was also weird because there were a couple of these kind of awkward plays in the sequence. I thought overall in the overtime, with the exception of those two threes early on, the Raptors got cleaner looks than Cleveland did. But what Cleveland accomplished, and I think the best representation of this was maybe even Tristan Thompson pulling that offensive rebound out of nowhere, though they didn't end up scoring because OG had a great, great play, was that Cleveland did a better job of kind of scrapping and getting the extra opportunities that are necessary in an overtime.
Well, they did end up scoring, actually. That the James OG played great defense on the James air ball, but then Thompson.
Oh, that's
Thompson
right.
Caught it under the rim.
It was the next.
And by the way, yeah,
it was the next one where he dribbled it eight times that they didn't score.
And then there was another one after that where Korver had a missed three, and the Raptors just like two Raptors came together and lost it out of bounds. That cost them another 24 seconds down the end too. The Raptors were down four most of the overtime. They managed to get back within one after the one transition play after James missed a sweeping hook. And really, anytime James misses a layup, that's really your chance to run because James is their best rim protector. And he missed quite a few layups or short shots, more from floater zone in this game. But, you know, plays where he's going to the rim, he couldn't get all the way there. So they actually ran it up. They got Love guarding Lowry in transition. Lowry went right by him and scored to bring within one. I thought that after the Raptors lost it out of bounds, Cleveland tried to run the time down. They tried to get the Korver pick and roll with James, but with only six on the shot clock, the Raps actually changed up their strategy. They were able to get defense replacements in the game. They still had DeRozan out there, but he was able to actually just switch on to James. It was late enough that James couldn't use his size against him, and James had to really force up a shot that missed, and there ended up being a shot clock violation which set up the last play.
Yeah, and I thought the last play, it led into something that has become so strange to see as frequently as we do, which is this robotic idea of seeking out the switch.
Yes.
Because, and yeah, if it had been Kevin Love, sure, by all means, Kevin Love, atrocious, generally, except for Game 7 of the 2016 NBA Finals, generally not great in terms of those switches.
I will say this about Love as a quick aside. When they actually switched a lot, even with Love, when the Raps had their bench unit out there without Lowry and DeRozan, I thought he actually held up just fine there.
Yeah, he did.
That unit just doesn't have enough one-on-one creators. I think actually the switching looked good against those guys, but sorry for that non sequitur.
No, that's fine. Because that wasn't the issue on this last possession with the Raptors down one. Instead, they robotically tried to get the switch of Tristan Thompson, who, considering his aptitude as a switch defender, you could argue was the better matchup, or at least that it wasn't worth taking the time to create that situation.
Well, and I think it's just not understanding what the strengths of DeMar DeRozan are, really. Like, DeMar DeRozan doesn't blow by guys, right? He uses his size, he uses his craft, he gets into position, and he likes to play over the top of guys. And so why wouldn't you just let him go at J.R. Smith as opposed to, like, I think he has much more of an advantage on Smith than Thompson, but it's a big man. But, like, you know, Tristan Thompson is a really, really good switch defender. Maybe not quite as good now as he was in his heyday a couple years ago, but he looked pretty close to the same player that he has been. And I thought that eventually, as DeRozan worked into position on Thompson, if he gets there on Smith, he's able to rise up over the top of Smith. And instead, he has to kind of pick it up, pump fake. And Jeff Green did a really nice job of helping on DeRozan, taking him off of that jumper that he wanted to shoot. And then Green still was able to get a great closeout on Van Vliet and force the miss. And it was game over.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is it's a really debilitating loss for the Raptors for a series of different reasons. I mean, as you said, one of the most important is losing home court. They are the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. One of the advantages there is that you get home court in every series. And now that advantage isn't there. So they have to win at least one game in Cleveland. They can. This is the best, still to me, the best of the Raptors teams that has faced Cleveland in the playoffs. But they have to do that, and they can't lose another game home. Otherwise, they have to win at least two games in Cleveland. And also that a lot of the Cavs, I mean, I think they'll play better. You're right to mention that Jeff Green, JR, and we'll see with Tristan. I mean, at least on the offensive glass, I wouldn't expect him to have that kind of a game. But Love can play better, or at least they can use him in a better role. LeBron will be more efficient with his shots. And maybe they'll finally learn, hey, let's play a little bit less Jordan Clarkson, because Jordan Clarkson, when LeBron is on the floor, especially, but anyway, he's just not providing much value because he just thinks every shot is a good shot.
All right, anything else on this game, or should we move on here to Warriors-Pels?
I think that's about enough there.
All right, well, first I want to tell you about our X-Bar before we talk Warriors-Pels. It's actually my favorite protein bar that I've had. It's made out of whole foods. They've got egg whites for protein, dates to bind it, nuts for texture. It tastes much better than your normal protein bar, where you really kind of just wonder what this, like, half-solid concrete is that you're eating. All of the core ingredients are labeled right on the front of the package. They have a bunch of great flavors, 11 to be exact. They're all gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, and free of any added sugar, artificial colors and flavors, preservatives, or fillers. You can actually taste the real fruit and the spices, sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors. There's an RX bar for you. You can get 25% off your first order via the link rxbar.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about it all the time on the program. And then, for good measure, enter the promo code capspace at checkout. Double capspace for this one. That's rxbar.com/capspace, promo code capspace. They'll get you 25% off your first order. And of course, let them know that you came from us. Well, clearly the big story here was the return of Steph Curry. How did he look to you in this game?
When a player comes back after missing, you know, an extended period of time, doesn't have to be 5 weeks, could be three or whatever, I generally look at kind of three different areas. One of them, in the case of a lower body injury, is just movement. Are they moving quickly, cutting, all that kind of stuff? And I thought Curry looked pretty good. Not unbelievable, but I actually thought he looked more fluid tonight than he did in the first, even the rest of that first round against Portland when he came back from the grade one MCL sprain in the 2016 playoffs. So that part was a positive, but not a strong positive. Then the other two areas are stamina and rust. And I thought there were certain moments in this game when Curry looked a little bit gassed, especially I think it was in the second half.
Yeah.
He was playing in
about 5 minutes left in third.
Yeah. He just looked like he lost it a little bit in terms of that. He still played well, obviously, but he, you could tell it had been a little while since he had played with that kind of an exertion for that period of time. And then the other one is rust. And the reason why I go in that order is because, and he looked rusty at moments in this game. The reason you go in that order is because it's an order of importance and how long you expect for those things to wear off. So rust comes pretty quickly, you know, next game, full practices, all that sort of stuff. Stamina can take a week or two or whatever, depending on the injury. We saw this with Joel Embiid as well. Embiid, you know, really struggled with stamina stuff in that first game back. And then eventually he got, you know, a little bit closer. And then movement can linger because if it's not there at the beginning, it's a little bit, it takes longer. So I would say overall, Curry looked better than I expected. And part of the reason why is because it was more in those later two, which are much more manageable than the first one, though it's not like he was exactly the same guy from a movement standpoint, which parallels what happened the last time Curry came back for an MCL sprain. I'll provide color on that. So basically, for those who don't remember, it's funny because as somebody who even talked about this in my book, of course, that last time when Curry came back from his MCL sprain. He also came off the bench, but that game went to overtime, and Curry actually set the NBA record for points scored in an overtime. So everybody's like, oh, he's back. And you and I actually cautioned on the podcast saying, well, his shot is looking good, but that wasn't all of what Steph Curry is. And I think that is still true here, though I do think he looked better physically than that night.
Yeah, I mean, the couple things you mentioned, the rust, he did have six turnovers, although two of those were in the really weird time late when the Warriors gave up all of a 14-point lead pretty much in the last 2 minutes of the game because New Orleans was pressing and they just like kept turning it over and giving up threes. I mean, it never got back to where New Orleans having a chance to tie, but they're actually within, I think it was 5 points at one point. But Steph, you know, he had some turnovers. I thought that like one play that showed the rust a little bit was he tried to go for a lefty floater that Anthony Davis just rejected. You know, I think that's kind of just not having that great of a memory for the speed of the game and what you can get away with. You know, those are the type of things that can show up with rust. But oh yeah, by the way, 28 points on 18 shooting possessions and 5 of 10 from 3. Did a nice job of drawing some BS fouls to get to the foul line as well. Not that they weren't fouls. One of them was a little dubious on Rondo, but you know, plays where he was able to just like get guys in the air and get fouled. And he, until that last jag of turnovers and weird presses and nobody, like he had plays where he would like dribble the ball in the front court and then like everyone else would still be in the back court and he just had no one to throw it to. He would have been plus 34, ended plus 26 in those 27 minutes. I suspect Kerr said early, oh, he's not going to be on a minutes limit, but the fact that he was brought off the bench, that he played exactly 27 minutes seemed, you know, to indicate that there was a minutes limit and he just didn't tell us about it.
Yeah, there wasn't a formally published one like a road sign, but there was an idea. And another way of kind of talking about Curry's impact in this game, and normally you don't want to talk about this with a single player, but I think it's at least somewhat applicable in this case. In Curry's 27 minutes, the Warriors had a 130 offensive rating, including the turnover palooza at the end of the game. In the 21 minutes Curry did not play, the Warriors posted an offensive rating of 72.7.
Yeah, he got up 10 three-point attempts. Klay got up 11. KD got up 7. And the 35 three-point attempts, they had that with 9 minutes remaining in the game. That was more than they'd had in any game since Steph's injury. And they finished it with 40, 13 out of 40, which wasn't a great percentage, although both teams shot it much better in the second half. And then it was also the fact that they had started Iguodala and Steph's own rest pattern being a little different meant that Kerr was able to go to the death lineup for the last 7 minutes of the game, and that was just completely unguardable down the end. KD, to use a favorite phrase of yours, was just ball racking whoever had him, was guarding him on the Pels. They started double teaming KD, and as soon as they did that, they helped off a Draymond, so Draymond just went and set a screen for Steph and got him a wide open three. KD even hit a ridiculous right shoulder fadeaway over two guys, including Anthony Davis. KD had struggled. He only had 14 points on 17 shots going into the fourth, but then he had 15 of his own in the fourth quarter, finishing with 29 and ultimately an efficient game. Much will be made, of course, of the Pels free throwing. 7 of 9, Drew Holiday and Anthony Davis combined for 24 shots and 0 free throw attempts. No one was asking questions of the Pels guys. I think everyone had left already. So I figured I should probably ask a few. And the first thing I asked them about was that free throw disparity, and here's what they had to say.
0 free throw attempts for Anthony and Drew tonight. Do you guys feel that you need to get to the line more? Is it that you're getting fouled and they're not calling it? Or do you guys need to attack harder?
We got to get to the line. I don't think I shot that many jumpers tonight. I don't think Drew shot that many. We both attacking the basket, you know.
48 FGAs, you know, both of those guys shot the ball, combined 48 times. You know, I think we were attacking just as they were. A lot, however you want to put it, didn't go our way, but that's not an excuse. Like I said, we got the shots we wanted. Our guys were aggressive, and, you know, things have turned, hopefully for the better in game 3.
So, Danny, with them saying, you know, implying, hey, you know what, we're driving to the rim, we're not taking jumpers, did you see a lot of plays that were borderline where you felt like they were getting fouled and weren't getting the call?
Not particularly. On drives, you know, maybe a couple. I mean, you see that all the time. But I wasn't struck by any particular player. I mean, AD had a couple of plays that were maybe a little bit there. But and Drew, you know, he had a couple of drives. But no, I didn't see it that way. And there were times I thought that the Pelicans got a rough whistle. You know, the disparity is not only that they took 9 free throw attempts, but that the Warriors took 27. There were a couple. You mentioned the one Curry that when he was fouled by Rondo, that was a little bit dubious. But overall, and this is very unusual for the Warriors, I thought the Warriors were the more aggressive team for most of it. And so I think they got some of the benefit of the officiating in that way that they almost never do.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember thinking at the time that like, oh man, these guys are getting murdered in the paint. They can't go. I mean, there was one where AD went up for an alley-oop, but that had been preceded by Draymond Green getting kind of a dubious foul, which was a non-shooting foul, when Rondo tried to throw a half-court alley-oop to AD. So, and yeah, you know, you're taking some shots in the paint, not necessarily at the rim as much though, but both Holiday and AD, a lot of those shots are shots that they're taking over a good contest and not necessarily even a help contest, right? It's okay, you got into the lane, but now you're kind of shooting like a floater, or AD in particular shooting that floater going to his left. You know, that's not really like a shot that you're necessarily drawing a foul on. You know, that's not really, hey, we're going up just like so strong through the defense here. On those plays, I thought that Looney did a fantastic job without fouling. He played great individual defense on AD. Again, and the big difference for AD in this series versus the Portland series is, you know, generally he's having to ISO a lot more, and he's not the greatest ISO guy in the world, right? I mean, he's a decent jump shooter. He's got that drive to his left, but he always has to bring it back to his right hand. He's got good touch on his floaters, but he's not really strong enough to move guys in the post. You know, that's really where Looney can be beaten in the post, but he's not really strong enough to move Looney, and Looney has good length to contest some of those floaters that he takes. So, you know, the Blazers series, they're playing conventional pick and roll defense, and he's just getting alley-oops and he's getting pick and pop jumpers against Nurkic whenever he wants to. You know, this is not the same animal there. And Holiday too, you know, he's being guarded by Kevin Durant. You know, and Kevin Durant can lay off him a little bit more, still contest his jump shot. Holiday had a really nice first half, but then was off in the second, or he's being guarded by Klay Thompson, who he's one of the few guys that he's not strong enough to just go right through. So I really didn't see like that many. You know, if you can say, hey, they took all these shots, they should get fouled more, but you don't have a God-given right to just get a certain number of foul calls. Like, you have to actually be fouled, and I'm hard pressed to remember the actual plays on which they were fouled. And maybe if someone wants to tweet me, because certainly Pels fans were very enamored of my tweet where I just simply noticed that they'd taken 48 field goal attempts and 0 free throws. And, you know, there's all the usual, it's rigged, blah, blah. All right, well, show me the film of all these fouls that took place where they couldn't get a call, you know, where it was so obvious. And I thought that most of the fouls that Golden State got were pretty obvious, especially in the second half. The first half, which was crazy, we should talk about the first half a little more. You know, both teams weren't taking any free throws at all. So they fouled a lot in the second half.
Well, and something else that I think is really important here is that the Pelicans weren't drawing fouls early in the quarters enough to get into the bonus, because that's another way that you can get free throws is by, you know, just accumulating those. I remember I think it was in the Cleveland Indiana game, where part of how Cleveland got into a rhythm was that they got into the bonus, and then Indiana was committing these reaches and fouls like that. So Cleveland was getting to the line on non-shooting fouls. That wasn't happening in this. The Warriors generally are pretty, they can be a pretty reasonably low foul team if they're not doing stupid reaches, and New Orleans wasn't really taking advantage of any of that. And that was actually how the Warriors got going offensively in the second quarter of game one. It wasn't as much of it as an emphasis here. But before we get into the first half, one thing I want to mention that I just can't let slide by in this game: Drew Holiday played 46 minutes and 33 seconds in this game of high intensity, a lot of times high difficulty minutes on both ends of the floor, you know, often guarded by Kevin Durant, sometimes guarding Kevin Durant. And a part of the reason
Steph Curry. I mean, this is like,
or Steph Curry.
Like, those are probably his two main matchups.
Right. And so Holiday has these incredibly high minutes. And part of the reason why they did that is because Ian Clark was just unplayable in game one. He had to play. He played a lot in game one and they got killed. And so in this game, they played Rondo 38 minutes, played Ian Clark just 6. And so Holiday had this incredible workload to do. And while, you know, he ended up not having his most efficient night, some of that coming, of course, from good defense and not getting to the free throw line. We already discussed that. It is incredibly impressive that he was able to handle that kind of a burden in a game like this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a player who went through years of being on minutes limits because of the stress reaction that he had in his tibia. That was really good. I mean, you mentioned the first half. Clark was -3 in 6 minutes, but I mean, he was just getting picked on left and right. They got nothing out of Solomon Hill either. I mean, this is a guy who they thought was going to be their starting small forward, thought was going to be the defensive solution on guys like Kevin Durant. That was is not the case. And Hill obviously is coming back from a hamstring injury, but he was 0-for-3 on three, just wide open three-pointers. And the Warriors were just treating him like he was Rondo. The first half was insane because it was 57 possessions. The first quarter was 30 possessions. I mean, it was 29-27, and both teams were below a point per possession. That's how fast things started off. And then 57 possessions, and there were 3 shooting fouls called in the entire first half. And part of that was just because it was so fast-paced, and both teams were just missing threes left and right. They both got up more than 23-point attempts. Both teams were below 25% on those threes. Actually, no, I'm sorry. That's not. The Warriors were like 6-21.
Yeah, the Warriors were at like 29%.
Yeah, but nonetheless, and both teams were getting some pretty open, easy shots, especially the Pels, I thought. I mean, for them to go 4-of-20 on threes in the first half, I mean, just so many open ones. Etuan Moore and Rondo are like the only guys who can hit shots. Finally, the Pels started hitting, and in the second half, they hit 9 threes. But some of those were late after the game had already been decided. And it really, they're going to rue all those missed open shots because they really were running it down the Warriors' source. The Warriors' transition defense was in, you know, regular season form, especially in the first quarter. But the Pels just couldn't take advantage. And then in the second half, I think they ran out of gas, pushing the ball a little bit to be sure. Rondo, though, did hit 3 out of his 4 3-pointers. That's been a continually interesting subplot here. 22 points, 12 assists. He was actually +2 in the game, had 3 offensive rebounds as well, although certainly his forays to the offensive glass can give up transition opportunities as well. And so the last question of the night was asked by me about Rondo. I wanted to know, you know, how he was feeling about the three-point shooting and the fact that they weren't guarding him. So here's what he had to say.
Rajon, you shot it well today from three-point range, but it seems like it's been a strategy of theirs to leave you open. You've never been a big volume three-point shooter in your career. Do you think you're shooting it well? Do you need to take more, or are you just focused on playing the same way you've played throughout your career?
Yeah, I'm just going to continue to play the way I've played my entire career.
So yeah, not particularly loquacious there. I shouldn't have probably given him quite as leading of a question as I did. It was the last question of the night. But nonetheless, I think that's interesting because, you know, he's not going to become this high volume shooter, right? I mean, he was 3 out of 4, but how many times was he not guarded where, you know, he passed up shots that kind of an average three-point shooter would have taken? And I mean, there is a play where Rondo was about to enter the ball to Anthony Davis, had the ball, and Draymond Green just ran away from him into the paint. Rondo actually hit that one. There was another play where Rondo entered the ball to Davis. Davis ended up scoring, but as soon as Rondo passed it, Draymond just sprinted towards the paint and actually ended up contesting AD's floater, which rimmed in. It was a tough shot. So the Draymond-Rondo matchup, I think, is still working reasonably well for the Warriors, and that's not going away. And I think, you know, Draymond said basically Rondo's a great player, but no, we're not going to change our strategy on him. And overall, until very late, the Pels did not score particularly well in this game. And to the extent that the defense was bad, it was in transition early where the matchups didn't really matter as much.
One other thing I wanted to make sure to mention was that there were a series of moments in this game where Anthony Davis was just everywhere defensively, where he'd just pop up and like the couple blocks on Curry, or he'd contest and freak a Warrior out when they were taking a shot. And he still has that crazy defensive ceiling. And it was kind of funny to see him and Draymond
he was gassed by doing the end, though.
Yeah. And then, I'm talking more of in the first half. Like Davis had that. And then you saw, like I talked about with Jrue Holiday, it's just the perils of them needing so much from these guys, because the threshold for beating the Warriors is just so high that you need all these players to play really well, and they just didn't have enough in this one. And you know, that could certainly swing for a game or two in the series, but this will be the first opportunity in the second round to say this. You know, the whole adage of, you know, a series doesn't start until the road team wins a game. Well, if the lower seed doesn't win a game in the first two, they have to win 4 out of 5, and that's real, real hard. And I mean, with this series, New Orleans, I absolutely think they can win a game or two for sure, but it would be shocking, barring significant injuries, for them to actually win the overall series.
Yeah, now with Steph Curry, the next game in the series is not until Saturday. You imagine maybe he'll still be on the minutes limit, but you know, maybe it gets bumped up enough to where they feel like they can start him, and that will get Nick Young hopefully completely out of the rotation. Once again, negative 11.
Well, I will note briefly, the next game is Friday, not Saturday.
Okay. But still, yeah. a pretty good break there.
Sure.
And for the Pels, I mean, you know, Darius Miller had 17 minutes off the bench. Everyone else was 10 or less. No starter played less than 36 minutes for the Pels. They really just do not seem to have the horses in this series. And the one time that I felt like they had like a real matchup advantage was Kerr went to Kevon Looney and David West together when AD and Mirotić were in the game. And so that meant that West had to guard AD, which he's really probably too slow to do. And AD scored on him really quickly. But then, you know, it was time for those guys to go out of the game. And so they had really one possession of that advantage. And other than that, I mean, there just aren't places to attack. And so even the Warriors, you know, they're able to withstand a 4-for-20 Klay Thompson shooting game. Like, that's not going to happen again. Draymond Green is shooting it okay. I mean, he continues to just be awesome. He had 20 points. I thought a couple of things that stuck out to me about both teams. I thought, it, at least in the first half, the Pels did a great job of slipping screens early against the Warriors' switches. And Rondo was throwing some amazing passes in that regard as well. The Warriors were able to clean that up in the second half. And then for the Pels, they didn't really seem to have that much of a plan against the Warriors' pick and rolls, whether it was KD, Klay, who actually had a very nice passing game, or of course Steph Curry, you know, whether it's coming off a screen, whatever, DHOs, whatever that situation is where, you know, it's ultimately a screen is being set for a shooter. So they're bringing, usually it'd be AD or sometimes Mirotić, all the way up to the level of the ball. They're not switching it, but they're just giving up the pocket pass way too easily to the roll man. And that's a big part of how Draymond was 7-11. He got some nice dunks right to the rim. Or, you know, he would just get a free run in and then he could find Iguodala along the baseline for a dunk or something like that. And so I think just, they either got to trap harder so that pocket pass isn't there. The big man's got to just take a little bit different of an angle on it. And then you can at least, you know, force whoever it is inside the three-point line and have a trail contest from behind. And, you know, Draymond Green as a role man is not like some big alley-oop threat where, like, you have to just stick close to him. So you have the big kind of be more on the angle to where he's up there, but he's also preventing that quick pocket pass, right? Because when you can throw that pocket pass as both guys are still moving towards the ball, I mean, there's just no way to get back in the play there. Or you maybe even just go with a little bit more conventional pick and roll defense, and especially if you've got Holiday on Steph Curry, just say, hey, you know, fight over the screen and we'll try to defend this. But you know, Steph hit a couple of really deep threes. I mean, he definitely had, I thought, more pep in his step maybe than he did. We'll just see what it looks like with him trying to get to the rim, but he also has more craft in his game now as far as getting to the foul line, and I think that's can really serve him well as he's trying to find his footing again here.
Yeah, and I would expect that we will see something closer to the Warriors' normal rotations. And a player mentioned...
Are they going to still start Iguodala?
I think they've really liked his intelligence defensively.
I mean, he's been much better in these playoffs than he was in regular season.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, so they could go in that direction. Another option would be to make a larger overall shift and also bring in Looney and just go to that at the beginning of the game and kind of go in some ways more to a traditional rotation. Yeah,
so that would
like
be
what Curry's done.
Iguodala out of the starting lineup, Curry in, and yeah. Looney in, and Young out, obviously.
Yes, of course. And so, yeah, that's one idea. I would kind of lean in that direction, but generally Kerr, you know, he attributed this after the game and my brain exploded a little bit. He said, oh, well, you know, we started Nick Young and things went so well in game one, so we did it again in game two. It's like, yeah, but Nick Young wasn't any part of what went well. So that same logic could be applied to having Iguodala in the starting lineup until things get different. So we'll see where it goes. Game three is on Friday, and I think that'll be New Orleans' best shot. They can certainly put a good game together. They've had some nice stretches in this. I mean, New Orleans has a ton of talent, but they're going to have to do it because the Warriors do not give you many chances when they're at full strength or anywhere close to it.
Well, and I think if Kerr actually does start the death lineup, that's certainly what I would advocate doing against the Houston Rockets, who, you know, might as well get those guys used to playing together. And especially, I think, getting off to a big start, you know, that was something that Curry was talking about in the presser of, like, you know, game three with the rogue crowd really fired up. Anything you could think of for adjustments for the Pels here going forward at all? I mean, it seems like they're doing everything they can at this point.
I'd like to see them give maybe a little bit more of a shot to Darius Miller. Just the virtue of another guy who can hit open shots. He ended up finishing this game 1-for-3 from the field with only 3 shots in 17 minutes. So there isn't a ton to build on there, but I would like to see Miller get an opportunity. I did like a lot of what Etuan Moore did. I just like Etuan Moore as a player. So maybe sliding a little bit around there, going a little bit smaller to see if he can make anything happen. But outside of that, I mean, it's going to be really hard, especially, and this is a huge change, is like, let's say the starting lineup for the Warriors gets back to being incredibly efficient with Curry, like they were with Curry on the floor here, it'll be harder for the Pelicans to get those opportunities to run. This is part of the idea of feedback loops, is that when you have fewer opportunities to run, then it's going to be harder for the Pelicans to score, and then it all goes in that direction. That's what we saw happen in the last 7 minutes of the game. So I think certain elements of what New Orleans did well in this game might actually taper off if the Warriors' offense gets going.
You could say that maybe they should try and hit the offensive glass harder, but I mean, AD is really the main guy to do that, and he's already just, you know, completely at the end of his rope as far as, you know, what he can do from an effort standpoint. I mean, he really just could not get out on the perimeter late in the game. I mean, maybe you could say, especially in the last 10 seconds of the shot clock, they should try and switch everything, that maybe getting Darius Miller out there can help with that a little bit more. But still, Etuan Moore, Rondo, even Holiday against KD. I mean, KD is really the biggest antidote to the switching. And we've seen KD, I think this year, get more comfortable, especially with Curry out, just rising up over the top of guys and shooting a mid-ranger. And that's just been a nearly automatic shot for him this year. So yeah, I'm not really sure where they can go from here. I think they can still try to push the pace. I think that's a great idea. I think the Warriors' transition defense can be vulnerable, and just hope to make some more threes and have the crowd carry you a little bit more from an effort standpoint in game three.
When they can, New Orleans should run off makes as well, just to put a little bit more pressure.
Especially a made layup as well. All right, we'll get to Philly and Boston, and we also got to talk about some of the news of the day. But first, this from Blinkist. We talk about efficiency all the time here. Well, and I think even my little like Twitter ad for Dunked On says, download as much information about the NBA as you can handle directly into your brain. Well, Blinkist will do that for you in audio form by transforming over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books into powerful packs you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. And frankly, you're reading a nonfiction book to get the information so you can apply it in your life. Are you really going to remember more than 15 minutes worth of information anyway for spending hours and hours reading this book? I don't think so. You can get the two insights from 2 to 3 books just on your commute home, potentially. If you have a 45-minute commute like I used to, a few of the titles they have available: Emotional Agility by Susan David, The Worry-Free Mind by Bill Wade and Carol Kershaw Ed. I have some family members who might be able to benefit from that. What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School by Mark McCormick, and as I mentioned, over 2,000 titles in all. The way to get started with them is Blinkist, BLINKIST, Blinkist.com/capspace to start your free trial, or you get 3 months off on a yearly plan. Once again, that's Blinkist.com/capspace. That /capspace URL, easy to remember because we talk about it all the time here on the program. Blinkist.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. Let's turn now to Monday night's game. Philly and Boston did not go according to plan. I thought that the big issue would be, can the Celtics stop the Sixers? And we just kind of assumed that the Celtics were going to struggle to score against Philly. That was not the case in the slightest, as it turned out.
Yeah, I mean, the Celtics posted a 122 offensive rating in this game, which is really impressive considering Philly's defense had looked pretty stout against the Heat. It should be noted that one of the things Boston did super well, that, and this is not meant to take anything away from them, that might change, is the way they attacked Marco Bellinelli. Bellinelli was truly awful in this game, and awful in the ways that we would anticipate. It's just that Boston went to it more often and more successfully. So one stat that I pulled related to that, the Sixers, so he played about 21 minutes. Actually, I think he played more than that. The Sixers had a 130 defensive rating when Bellinelli was on the floor, and in the minutes he didn't play, they had had a 102 defensive rating.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, oh, hey, let's just go isolate Marco Bellinelli in the post so much, although they did go to that a little bit. They were able to straight line drive him. A lot of it was just running through the course of their offense and then Bellinelli making a mistake in terms of like a switch or a back screen, something like that. He's actually makes a lot of bad decisions and fails to execute in addition to being limited physically. I mean, the difference between him and J.J. Redick defensively, I'd say Bellinelli actually has better physical tools than Redick does. It is pretty remarkable because Redick at least rarely makes mistakes. My biggest takeaway from this, though, was we said this a lot during the season. It didn't really come up much in the Miami series. And I think Miami is, you know, a first round playoff type of team. I think everyone acknowledges that. Boston, while certainly they're limited offensively, their defense is elite, well beyond where Miami was even, because they don't really have the weak links. And we were so curious to see the Sixers in the playoffs. This is more something we talked about, you know, before the last month of the season when they went on that awesome run. And I think maybe we kind of forgot about this a little bit. Was this is a team with such severe strengths and weaknesses, right? I mean, we can list them off. There's Joel Embiid, his ability in the post. He was at times unstoppable in this game. Ben Simmons can't shoot at all. Amazing in transition. Amazing passer. Turns it over a lot. The defense, Embiid, Covington, Simmons to a lesser degree. Great defensive players. Redick, Bellinelli. Saric is only okay as an individual defender. Not as good, right? Just their overall turnovers as a team. They're a very good rebounding team. They're a great transition team. All of that to me, and then the number of threes that they get up to, I mean, this is now with them going 5 out of 26 from three, I think is now the fourth game they've had where they've been under 30% from three on a pretty large number of attempts. So 26 is not as many as they've been shooting in the Miami series, and it might even be their third game with under 20% three. All of that leads to just a crap load of variance for this team, and I felt like that was a big part of this game. All those factors that we talked about, most of them really came up negative in this game for the Sixers, other than Embiid's scoring the post, which is something I want to talk more about later as well.
And we did see elements, limited as they were, of their strengths. I thought one thing that was interesting was how critical after the game and today as well, Embiid was of his own defense. And I mean, you could go in different directions with this, but Boston shot 74% at the rim. However, they had fewer attempts than usual, so you can kind of go in both directions there. And he didn't do as much to dissuade certain things, but also we talked about, you know, the Sixers shooting below 30% from three. Boston also was 17 of 35, and so some of that was generating better looks than they usually do. A larger proportion, especially of Rozier's shots, were very clean, and he can hit open shots. But I expect both of those things to kind of go to the mean, and that would help out. And something that struck me during this game was I thought the Celtics just dramatically outplayed the Sixers throughout, and yet despite all of that, it was still a 10-point game with like 8 minutes to go. And so I expected the Celtics to win. I expected them to close it out kind of in the way that they did. But you're sitting there going, well, it wouldn't have to be that different for this to have a different story.
Yeah, that's true. I think you mentioned Embiid being critical of his own defense. I agree, but I thought some of the biggest shots were Aaron Baines hitting those two corner threes. And he, although he shot very poorly on those in the regular season, he's looked very comfortable shooting them in the playoffs. I think now with some of their more offensive limitations that he's been given the green light to shoot those. And then of course Horford's spacing as well caused big problems, and those guys combined 4 out of 6 from three. But I mean, there are a bunch of plays where, you know, Horford operating with the ball out in the perimeter in DHOs, and Embiid, he's got to get out there or Horford's just going to shoot that three. And there's another play I thought was telling. I think it was the end of the third quarter where Baines, actually they set a screen for him to take a corner three, and Embiid like had to like get through that screen and get out there and guard him. And that's just going to be difficult for Joel Embiid. And then, like with so many centers, when you get spaced out, all right, I can guard you on the perimeter, but now can I guard you on the perimeter and also have my effect at the rim? But even so, they only had 48% on two-pointers. You know, that's not ridiculous. It was just the three-point shooting, the 17 out of 35. And certainly, I thought they gave up too much in transition. The Sixers did. They are outscored in transition 13 to 10, which is not going to be good for them in this series. What else did you have here?
I thought the biggest tactical mistake mistake in game one, and it floored me that it happened, was Brett Brown being so comfortable with Redick, especially sometimes Bellinelli, guarding Jason Tatum. Tatum had a fabulous night. And the reason why it stunned me was because without Jaylen Brown, who is hoping that he will be back for game two, which would be great, want him to be back, Boston didn't have that many threats. And so they focused to me on putting Simmons, who is a capable help defender, to be sure, putting him on Marcus Smart. And so that's kind of the idea of creating that different strength. But Redick could not handle Jason Tatum. Tatum got to the line 12 times in this game, also did a nice job shooting from the field. Great game for Tatum. I think his best game of the playoffs so far. And so I'm just sitting there going, well, what are you gaining and what are you losing? And it was a strange value proposition for me against a Boston team in particular in this game that just didn't have a ton of shot creation. It was more just taking advantage of the seams that were created.
I actually think that this is being slightly overplayed, the Redick on Tatum issue, because they're switching 1 through 3 almost all the time, and sometimes even 1 through 4 out in the perimeter. And I understand the strategy of having Simmons be a help defender. He was not as effective as a help defender in this game as he often is. But I mean, you're not going to just not switch, because they run a lot of stuff out in the perimeter where two guys screening for a guy coming out of the corner. Boston loves to run guys out of the corner, as does Philly offensively. And so are you just going to not switch that? Are you going to let someone just come around a double screen and not switch that? I don't think you are. And so a lot of those plays, it's not like Tatum was just, I'm just going to back down JJ Redick and go one-on-one. It's the same stuff that Boston does a lot of times where they get an advantage coming out of the corner. They're able to reverse the ball, extend that advantage, get a straight line drive to the rim. Those are a lot of those plays. So I'm not sure that, you might start Redick on Smart, and Smart struggled again offensively, although he did have 9 assists. He finally hit his first 2 3-pointers of the playoffs, but was just 3 of 12 overall, 2 of 8 from 3. Certainly took some bad ones again. But I'm not sure really that it's going to make that big of a difference. Now, if you want to say, hey, you shouldn't be playing Bellinelli and Redick together, now you're more speaking my language here, because then there just become too many places to attack. Another thing I think we have not been talking enough about in these playoffs, because it felt like last series that we were really talking more about some of the Bucks problems, is just how incredible Al Horford has been in these playoffs. He looks more comfortable than at any time in his career, posting up another 26 points and 4 assists for him. Philly should be doing a better job on him, to be sure. Some of his face-up jumpers, they're letting him drive to his right hand on closeouts, but he is just shooting the ball extremely well. When he gets a mismatch, he's going to work in the post, driving to the basket. He's really is just playing with better offensively than really probably at any time in his career right now.
I've been very impressed so far in these playoffs with his feel of when to attack, when to pass the ball, finding the reads. And Horford's always been a smart, capable offensive player, but I think it's partially the marriage of this Horford with the surrounding talent in the system that it allows him to get into those spots to, okay, this is a good time to post up, to get the mid-range shot, sees the guy leaning in a different direction. And he has the freedom to make those decisions, which I think a lot of other coaches are uncomfortable with giving to a guy who's 6'10 or taller.
And Al also, he gets so many buckets just from being smart. He just knows when to roll at the perfect time. If for some reason they get 2 on the ball, he can roll right in for an alley-oop dunk. He did that one. But that's not generally what he's going to be doing, right? He's generally going to be popping. He's generally going to be out in the perimeter, DHO, looking to get other guys go backdoor, which again, he's excellent at as well. But he's when the pop is there, he'll do that. When the roll is there, he'll do that. And we've been critical of the Bucks and also the Sixers for giving up too many system buckets. But credit needs to go for the Celtics for being smart enough to create those system buckets, to take advantage of the mistakes and the openings when they arise. Another guy I thought we really needed to discuss in this one, even though he again is a relative non-factor on offense, only 1 out of 4, was Semi Ojeleye. I think that he took a charge early, had a couple of nice help defense plays. He was plus 11 in 22 minutes. And just to get another guy, how many teams, Miami basically didn't have anyone, right? I guess you could say Winslow was the only guy that you felt was a good option on Simmons. Well, Al Horford did a really nice job. And Ojeleye is just another guy. And in transition, especially with his strength, right? You'll see Giannis or Ben Simmons be able to get going downhill, cross over, and then kind of bump the guy off the path and go in for a layup. Well, Ojeleye is too strong for that. And you saw a couple times they would try and drive and just kind of bounce off Ojeleye and have to give the ball up. So he just, to give them another option of a guy who just can't be taken advantage of defensively, was huge. And then he at least hit one shot from 3. So that was enough to sort of keep the defense honest, at least.
Yeah, I thought he did well. I think we should also spend a little bit more time talking about Terry Rozier. Rozier had a really nice game overall. And there was this big sequence in, I think it was the second quarter, where he crossed up Bellinelli and got into the lane for a jump shot. And then the next time down, it was in transition. They got a nice stop. And he just pulls up for 3. Nobody really got on him right away. And it was a good example, beyond all the defensive plays that Rozier made, of really what he can do. He could take advantage. He is quick. And he had this one crazy play where I was convinced it was that, I think it was an alley-oop to Marcus Morris, where I was convinced he like just lost the ball. But when I watched it another time, it seemed like he had control and just did a,
no, he,
was a
nice
handle
through
play.
Like three,
like,
guys.
It was amazing.
Threw up a nice alley-oop to Marcus Morris, not exactly known as a Skywalker. That was towards the end of the first quarter. I mean, if he shoots, he's just made himself into a very, very good shooter. He's played much better, of course, at home in these playoffs. And I think just overall, we haven't given the Celtics enough credit for how good they've been at home, and they do have the home court advantage in this series and may have it in the next one, depending on what happens if they are able to go through here.
I wanted to, one other thing I wanted to ask you was, did you think, I thought about this a couple different times, did you think Ben Simmons played too many minutes in this game?
You know, 42 minutes is a lot. I don't think they played, did they even play McConnell at all in the second half? If they did, it wasn't much.
I don't believe they did. If they did, it was really short. I don't remember being on the
court. You know,
the
Boston crowd was so jealous that McConnell was on the other team. But yeah, I mean, especially because we were done at the end here. I mean, Simmons was probably on track to play 44 minutes. And then the last two, it was just enough of a blowout that they waved the white flag. Maybe part of that was because Robert Covington had maybe the worst defensive game I can ever remember him having. Maybe his shooting, he was 0 for 6. His only points were on a 3-shot foul. 0 of 4 from 3. He missed a couple of open ones. And he, in the third quarter, gave up an open 3 to Rozier when he was guarding him, just basically lost him, and then gives up an easy backdoor to Tatum. But only 27 minutes for him. The Sixers were actually scoring really well in the fourth quarter and then just couldn't stop the Celtics. And that's when they had both Redick and Bellinelli on the floor. And I'm sorry, there are just no situation in which Marco Bellinelli should ever play more minutes than Robert Covington. I don't care how bad of a game Robert Covington is having, unless he's just injured or something, because there's no indication he was. Like, this was coaching recency bias, just sticking with the wrong guy. Robert Covington is 1,000 times better player than Marco Bellinelli. And yeah, you know what? You shouldn't be surprised if you can't get any stops with both Redick and Bellinelli on the floor. They got away with that against Miami. Against this Boston team, it's probably actually a better offensive team, it seems like, than that Miami team was, especially at home. And so I thought that was a mistake from Brown to not go back to Covington. I don't care how bad of a game he's playing. Like, you're just, Marco Bellinelli is not better than him. It's not like Bellinelli was like absolutely on fire offensively in this game. And this is, I started to say this earlier, like, this is where the real playoff starts for Philly now, right? Like, now your weaknesses are actually going to start getting exploited. Miami just didn't have the firepower to do that. And now I think that's going to be a problem. So, but Philly, I mean, 5 out of 26 3-point shooting. I thought that's a pretty low number for them, in part due to good defense from the Celtics. They missed the, in terms of number of attempts, 26 times. They missed some open ones, to be sure, but I didn't think that the quality of their three-point looks was amazing. But Šarić 0 for 4, Covington 0 for 4, Ilyasova 0 for 3, that combined 0 for 11. I mean, those are sort of the, you assume that Redick and Bellinelli are going to shoot it reasonably well, and they're always going to have the gravity, but those are kind of the variable three-point shooters for this team, and Šarić in particular not shooting well was a problem. What did you think of the strategy to basically guard Joel Embiid one-on-one under all circumstances? I mean, he had a wonderful offensive game statistically, 31 points, 12 of 21, 2 of 5 from 3, also had 5 assists, but I still thought the strategy was effective for Boston.
Yeah, I was surprised. At first, I hated it just because Embiid is capable of dominating a one-on-one matchup against damn near everybody, but what I grew to appreciate over the course of the game was that I thought it decreased the quality of the looks that every other Sixer got. And it's sort of the logic I had previously argued years and years ago, when Dallas was going against Miami in the 2011 finals, that the Heat should have done with Dirk about, hey, you have this really talented offensive player, but bet on everybody else not being able to do much if you don't give them the space to operate. And it was interesting. I'm not still sure. I mean, if Philly made a higher proportion of their shots, and yes, they were, I would say they were better contested than most threes are, so you can get a little bit lower in terms of the percentage there. but I liked it more than I expected. I'm still a little dubious.
Yeah, you know, it just, they kept throwing it to him and he kept scoring. And when he wasn't scoring, he was getting very good shots. He had a couple of turnovers. I think that if this series takes on a more defensive bent, that they will have to potentially reevaluate that, right? That, but right now, Embiid going one-on-one, you're only still going to have so much success one-on-one in the post in this day and age. I think it would be difficult for him to score better in the post than he did in this game. You have to imagine if they go to the same strategy next game, to say that he's going to be even more effective seems unlikely. And it really helped to cause problems for the other guys. So I would stick with it if I were Boston. They did a great job of not fouling, even though they had to guard one-on-one. I mean, that's the other part too. Like, if you start fouling on those plays, especially if it's Horford, who basically, I mean, it's pretty amazing as important as he's been, that he basically has not been in foul trouble this entire playoffs. So I would stick with it if I were Boston and see if you can deny. It also just kind of slows Philly down a little bit. It tires out Embiid, maybe you could say, on the defensive end as well, where he didn't have one of his best defensive games. Anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I think that's about it. I'm really excited to see where the series goes. I picked the Sixers in six games, but expected Boston to win game one just because I thought Stevens would have a good game plan for it, and now we get to see where it goes.
Yeah, the last point I wanted to make is transition. Ben Falk had a nice piece on this morning as we're recording this, on how Boston was having their center basically sprint back and get to the free throw line to take away some transition right at the rim for Simmons, and then Philly likes to go into some dribble handoffs with Covington or Redick out of transition with Simmons on the side, and then Simmons can kind of roll to the rim. But they did a pretty good job of taking that away as well. But in large part, I think due to the missed threes, Philly off a live rebounds only 83 offensive rating, and they ran only 22% of the time, which is very low. I mean, this is a great transition team over the course of the season. And then for Boston, they were actually able to run pretty well themselves, so that was big. We'll have to see how the transition plays out in future games of this series. Shall we do a little news here before we depart?
Yeah, there's certainly a couple of things to talk about. I we could do a couple quick ones first. Tyler Johnson had surgery to repair the ulnar collateral ligament in his left thumb. I mean, we saw the contraption that he had on over the last couple of days of the playoffs. The projection is that Tyler Johnson will be in a cast for 6 weeks, expected to make a full recovery. But I'm amazed that he
missed
played.
It. Basically, like, I think the ligament that he tore is the one that basically just like keeps your thumb from like flopping down away from your hand. And so they just put a piece of tape connecting the end of his thumb to the end of his index finger so that like his thumb wouldn't just like fall off the side of his hand, basically. Like, it was just, I mean, obviously it wouldn't fall off, but like just in terms of like having some ability to just like keep that thumb in place. I'd never seen anything like that before. I mean, it might be that Kevin Love, it seems like, is going through something pretty similar there. But yeah, so Johnson should be back. In OKC, Carmelo Anthony had a very, very interesting exit interview. And obviously there's the drama there as far as Paul George returning. But Melo basically said a number of things. His direct quote on if he'd ever come off the bench: I'm not sacrificing no bench role. That's out of the question. And he also said basically that, and I don't know if I buy this because they still did have a whole training camp, that because he came here right before training camp, he essentially said that like he had to play this role because it wasn't part of their system. And maybe that means that that's Russell Westbrook not passing up. But he basically was like, well, because I got here right at the start of training camp, I wasn't a main part of the system. He said basically, I don't think I can be successful in playing a role that he had to play this year. And so I actually was talking to a player about his situation the other day, and that player was like, well, you know, at some point he's going to have to decide whether it's going to be about him or it's going to be about the team. Does he want to be the guy who's shooting all the time and the main focus, or is he going to acknowledge that if you want to be on a winning team, he's not good enough to be that guy anymore on a winning team, and that you're going to have to play a role? And so what I asked the player was, well, you know, when he tried to play the role and he couldn't make his shots, right? Can he even do that? And so his response was, there's a lot of stuff that goes into a shot. And it seems like, based on his comments, that Melo was kind of had these thoughts all year of, you know, this isn't supposed to be my role. I'm not supposed to just be a spot up shooter. And that just kind of messed with him mentally, and he wasn't playing with freedom to be who he wanted to be, or that there was some resentment, and that's why he was missing shots. I don't know if I buy that, but I mean, I think there might be something to that in terms of the psychology of the shots that he was taking and what his role was. And so everyone was saying the right things. Billy Donovan was like, all right, he sacrificed so much, blah, blah, blah. But if Carmelo isn't going to acknowledge acknowledge the reality of the player that he is at this point, they're going to be in trouble. And, you know, maybe that means a buyout, maybe that means a trade. But, you know, really that is, that whole part is secondary to what happens with Paul George. And then maybe if Paul George leaves, then they'll just need Carmelo Anthony to be more of a scorer next year, and he'll be happier in his role, whether he'll be effective or not. I suppose we will have to see. But I thought all that is just very, very interesting.
Yeah, I felt the same way, and it's small sample size theater to be sure, and there are, I have issues with why this is as small sample as it is. But so Melo only played 3 minutes per game without Russ on the floor, and his usage rate went from 21.5% to 39.4%, and his efficiency actually did go up. It went up from 50 to about 55% true shooting, and you know that's not as big a jump as you would hope, considering he was rough when Westbrook was on the floor, and this is a small sample size. But if that that's the way Melo felt, I'm sure he expressed that to people in coaching staff, it always made more sense to me to kind of do the, I've termed this the stagger plus before, of like, what I mean by a stagger plus is that guys play together, but you make it a goal to separate them as much as you can, to do that with Melo and Westbrook. Then they could have had these competent minutes, but they also had the balancing that I think Paul George wanted Paul George time too. And so maybe they prioritize that a little bit more, and they won't have to do that theoretically if Paul George leaves.
But what this really gets back to is, how did the team actually play during Melo time? You know, like that's a, and they actually ended up finding with units with none of those three players on the floor that did better as bench units, as it turned out. And that's because Melo, while he himself may have scored a little bit better, the team didn't score that well, and they didn't defend that well. And obviously, I mean, that's another thing, you know, like really, you know, if Melo were able to, I mean, what he really needs to do is get into great shape so he doesn't get killed on defense every single possession in close games, try to fix it so he can be at least a passable switch defender, and then work on his spot up shooting, you know. But it does not sound like that is something that he is remotely interested in. More drama here, and I am happy to discuss this on my own out of San Antonio. Ramona Shelburne and Mike Wright had a great long piece on Kawhi. I thought the most interesting part to come out of this, because I've long maintained that the injury is the biggest issue here, right? And whether he's going to be healthy enough to play or not, even in the future, is going to be the issue. So Kawhi's camp apparently believed that the issue stemmed from a number of quad contusions that he suffered going back to 2016. He missed a few games over the last couple of years with the quad contusion. And what that caused was basically, I think the term is ossification, where the quad muscle itself, it started to develop issues. And then that is what caused the tendon soreness, because basically there's just this tightness in the quad, this weakness in the quad from the multiple contusion. And the Spurs said, you know, no, basically it's a tendon issues. And so it seems like, reading between the lines, that when he was cleared, it's, hey, your tendon is now healthy. And Kawhi's like, no, well, the muscle itself is not healthy. That needs to continue to be rehab. And for me, I almost always side with the player. I can't remember a time that I didn't on these sorts of issues. Like, they know their body. These guys are generally competitors to get to the NBA, especially a guy like Kawhi, who's been a tireless worker throughout his career and a great competitor to be the type of guy that he is. For him to say, hey, you know what, I don't feel right. And yeah, you know what, if the Spurs, and people are like, oh, the Spurs medical staff is so good, just trust them, they have this great, great history. Like what kind of a guy would just leave the Spurs medical staff and seek an outside opinion? Well, what would you do if doctors were telling you that you're fine and it still hurts? Obviously, you're going to seek a second opinion, because they're not telling you why it hurt. Are you supposed to just pretend that it doesn't hurt? So he's been in New York. You know, there's more detail. I recommend reading the whole piece to be sure. Also, some of the reporting on just the nature of Kawhi's camp, his agent, Mitch Frankel, some rancor between Kawhi and the organization seemed to start when his partner, Brian Elfus, left. Kawhi appears to be Frankel's only client at this point. They were trying to start this agency. They had some football players, but now it appears that Frankel is just operating completely on his own. And meanwhile, his uncle has been trying to find a way to start a marketing arm at other agencies based on Kawhi, which the agencies weren't interested in it. And again, this is just a summary. I recommend reading the whole piece to get a sense of it. So all of this doesn't really shed a ton of light on things going into the future. Nobody knows whether the Spurs are going to offer that designated player veteran extension or not. Presumably, everyone's going to have to be convinced that he's healthy to do that. There are also a few rumors in the story, which I'm not going to put a ton of stock in. I mean, we've heard a couple of these now that seem to come from other executives. One of them, in a different story, was Kawhi doesn't want to have to practice as hard under Pop. Another one one was that the Spurs have fears, and this is coming from another executive on another team, it sounds like. The Spurs have fears that he wants to go to either one of the LA teams, the Knicks, or the Sixers. Again, I don't know how much stock to put in that. And of course, those teams cannot offer him the designated player veteran extension and certainly cannot offer it anytime soon. If he were to be traded, he would have to wait 6 months before he could sign an extension. And even then, the extension wouldn't be anywhere near the amount, because it would just be the 120% increase off of what he's making now, which is less 20. So that's not really a starter either. And so the Spurs are still in such a good economic position if they offer that, that it still is difficult for me to imagine him not taking it. It's just kind of the ball's in their court and the ball's in Kawhi's court to see whether he can get healthy or not. And then we'll really see where the rubber meets the road with this situation. Anything else we need to talk about here?
Yeah, just briefly, the Suns have removed interim head coach Jay Triano from consideration for the head coaching spot. So we don't know exactly who it's going to be, but it'll be a change. And that's, you know, that's notable. I'll also plug my offseason preview for the Dallas Mavericks, which I think is an under-the-radar, super interesting offseason. So I wrote about that and kind of the balancing of 2018 versus 2019 when they could have as much as like $75 million in space if a bunch of things happen, and I lay out what those are. And so their offseason that I'm writing, you know, a bunch of them. So there is probably going to be at least three per week every week at The Athletic, and they already have a backlog of them. I'm actually writing the Bucks one right now, so we'll see when that one goes up too.
All right, and we'll probably be getting into our offseason previews, I would guess, tomorrow, since there's only one game tomorrow night. And Twitter NBA Show will return tomorrow for Utah and Houston. We've been off the last couple of days, but we'll be back now that my sanity has been restored, and we will talk to y'all then.